Chapter 21. The Greeks and the Persians. First, the Hellenic peoples. Second, distinctive features of Hellenic civilization. Third, monarchy, aristocracy, and democracy in Greece. Fourth, the kingdom of Lydia. Fifth, the rise of the Persians in the east. Sixth, the story of Croesus. Seventh, Darius invades Russia. Eighth, the Battle of Marathon. Ninth, Thermopylae and Salamis. 10th, Plataea and Mycale. First, the Greeks appear in the dim light before the dawn of history, say 1500 BC, as one of the wandering, imperfectly nomadic Aryan peoples who were gradually extending the range of their pasturage southward into the Balkan Peninsula and coming into conflict and mixing with that preceding Aegean civilization of which Knossos was the crown. In the Homeric poems, these Greek tribes speak one common language, and a common tradition upheld by the epic poems keeps them together in a loose unity. They call their various tribes by a common name, Hellenes. They probably came in successive waves. Three main variations of the ancient Greek speech are distinguished, the Ionic, the Iolic, and the Doric. There was a great variety of dialects. The Ionians seem to have preceded the other Greeks and to have mixed very intimately with the civilized peoples they overwhelmed. Racially, the people of such cities as Athens and Miletus may have been less Nordic than Mediterranean. The Doric apparently constituted the last most powerful and least civilized wave of the migration. These Hellenic tribes conquered and largely destroyed the Aegean civilization that had preceded their arrival. Upon its ashes, they built up a civilization of their own. They took to the sea and crossed by way of the islands to Asia Minor, and, sailing through the Dardanelles and Bosphorus, spread their settlements along the south and presently along the north borders of the Black Sea. They spread also over the south of Italy, which was called at last Magna Graecia, and round the northern coast of the Mediterranean. They founded the town of Marseille on the site of an earlier Phoenician colony. They began settlements in Sicily in rivalry with the Carthaginians as early as 735 BC. In the rear of the Greeks proper came the kindred Macedonians and Thracians. On their left wing, the Phrygians crossed by the Bosphorus into Asia Minor. We find all this distribution of the Greeks effected before the beginnings of written history. By the 7th century BC, that's to say by the time of the Babylonian captivity of the Jews, the landmarks of the ancient world of the pre-Hellenic civilization in Europe have been obliterated. Tiryns and Knossos are unimportant sites. Mycenae and Troy survive in legend. The great cities of this new Greek world are Athens, Sparta, the capital of Lacedaemon, Corinth, Thebes, Samos, Miletus. The world our grandfathers called ancient Greece had arisen on the forgotten ruins of a still more ancient Greece, in many ways as civilized and artistic, of which today we are only beginning to learn through the labors of the excavator. But the newer ancient Greece of which we are now telling still lives vividly in the imaginations and institutions of men because it spoke a beautiful and most expressive Aryan tongue akin to our own, and because it had taken over the Mediterranean alphabet and perfected it by the addition of vowels, so that reading and writing were now easy arts to learn and practice, and great numbers of people could master them and make a record for later ages. Second, now this Greek civilization that we find growing up in South Italy and Greece and Asia Minor in the 7th century BC is a civilization differing in many important respects from the two great civilized systems whose growths we have already traced, that of the Nile and that of the two rivers of Mesopotamia. These civilizations grew through long ages where they are found. They grew slowly, about a temple life, out of a primitive agriculture. Priest-kings and god-kings consolidated such early city-states into empires. But the barbaric Greek herdsmen raiders came southward into a world whose civilization was already an old story. Shipping and agriculture, walled cities, and writing were already there. The Greeks didn't grow a civilization of their own. They wrecked one and put another together upon and out of the ruins. To this we must ascribe the fact that there is no temple-state stage, no stage of priest-kings in the Greek record. The Greeks got at once to the city organization that in the East had grown round the temple. They took over the association of temple and city. The idea was ready-made for them. What impressed them most about the city was probably its wall. It's doubtful if they took to city life and citizenship straight away. At first, they lived in open villages, outside the ruins of the cities they'd destroyed. But there stood the model for them, a continual suggestion. They thought first of a city as a safe place in a time of strife, and of the temple, uncritically, as a proper feature of the city. They came into this inheritance of a previous civilization with the ideas and traditions of the woodlands still strong in their minds. The heroic social system of the Iliad took possession of the land and adapted itself to the new conditions. As history goes on, the Greeks became more religious and superstitious as the faiths of the conquered welled up from below. We've already said that the social structure of the primitive Aryans was a two-class system of nobles and commoners, the classes not very sharply marked off from each other, and led in warfare by a king who was simply the head of one of the noble families, primus inter pares, a leader among his equals. With the conquest of the aboriginal population and with the building of towns, there was added to this simple social arrangement of two classes a lower stratum of farm workers and skilled and unskilled workers who were, for the most part, slaves. But all the Greek communities were not of this conquest type. Some were refugee cities, representing smashed communities, and in these the aboriginal substratum would be missing. In many of the former cases, the survivors of the earlier population formed a subject class, slaves of the state as a whole, as for instance the Helots in Sparta. The nobles and commoners became landlords and gentlemen farmers. It was they who directed the shipbuilding and engaged in trade. But some of the poorer free citizens followed mechanic arts, and as we've already noted, would even pull an oar in a galley for pay. Such priests as there were in this Greek world were either the guardians of shrines and temples or sacrificial functionaries. Aristotle, in his Politics, makes them a mere subdivision of his official class. The citizen served as warrior in youth, ruler in his maturity, priest in his old age. The priestly class, in comparison with the equivalent class in Egypt and Babylonia, was small and insignificant. The gods of the Greeks proper, the gods of the heroic Greeks, were, as we've already noted, glorified human beings, and they were treated without very much fear or awe. But beneath these gods of the conquering freemen lurked other gods of the subjugated peoples, who found their furtive followers among slaves and women. The original Aryan gods weren't expected to work miracles or control men's lives. But Greeks, like most of the Eastern world in the 1000 years BC, was much addicted to consulting oracles, or soothsayers. Delphi was particularly famous for its oracle. When the oldest men in the tribe couldn't tell you the right thing to do, says Gilbert Murray, you went to the blessed dead. All oracles were at the tombs of heroes. They told you what was Themis, what was the right thing to do, or, as religious people would put it now, what was the will of the god. The priests and priestesses of these temples were not united into one class, nor did they exercise any power as a class. It was the nobles and free commoners, two classes which in some cases merged into one common body of citizens, who constituted the Greek state.